Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Kurt Schmidt, the president of Foundry and host of the Schmidtless Podcast. And we're going to talk about optimizing processes in UI UX teams today. This episode is brought to you by Balsamiq, a low-fidelity wireframing tool. Basically, it's like sketching on a whiteboard, but on the computer. The idea is to get the structure of your user interface down before you start coding or sweating the details in Sketch. Try their new web app, Balsamiq Cloud, free for 30 days at balsamiq.cloud. Hey, Kurt. Thank you for making the time for us today.
Thank you for having me.
How about we start with a short questionnaire and then continue with the main topic?
Sounds great.
Awesome. And question number one is, what do you do for a living?
So currently I'm the president of Foundry, which is a digital product design, strategy, and development company located in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
That was very concise. What is your background story? How did you get started?
Sure. So I grew up very interested in graphic arts. I come from a very artistic family. And as I got older, when the internet came around, I got excited because people could start to interact with my designs. They could move, they could animate, all these different things. And I got more and more interested in user experience and web development. And then over the years, I found that I was much better at leading teams than actually doing the design work. There was a lot better designers out there than me and a lot better developers. But I found a good calling in managing and leading teams. And so that's what I've been doing. And that's how I got to where I'm at.
Tell us a bit more about Foundry. What exactly you do? How large of a team is that? Is it a
Sure.
boutique, smaller type, or larger
Yeah.
type?
It is a smaller team. So currently, we have anywhere from 8 to 12 people that work with us at any given time. We are split directly in half by user experience design and research and strategy, and then software development for applications, mobile apps, integrations, all those sorts of things.
Awesome. The next question is, what does your typical day look like?
My typical day looks like a lot of meetings. as the president of the company, I spend a lot of time in outreach. So as you mentioned at the top of the podcast, I also do my own podcast, and I spend a lot of time talking with individuals in the community, doing business development, working on what the future looks like for the company, talking with clients, and obviously working side by side with the designers and developers to make sure they're set up for success.
Awesome. Are you, let's say, an early riser or, late afternoon productive person? Do you have any special tips for making all these things happen?
Well, to be honest, something I kind of stopped doing a while ago. I've always wanted to be a morning person, and I've tried, but usually I get a lot more done, in the evenings after everybody's gone to sleep. But for me, I'm a very analog person. I like my notebook and I like to keep notes there. But I got rid of all of my my to-do apps and my to-do lists, and just started focusing on when I had something that I needed to do, I just did it instead of putting it on a list for later. That actually was a great change that I made a while back. It's helped me stay a bit more on top of things.
Sounds like a great strategy. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I would say the most is the people. Obviously, the working with teams and building software is a passion of mine. And when you're just working with a great team, there's nothing that feels better. When everybody's working well together and you've got a great client and they're very integrated with the team, it's such a great, it's such a great experience. It really feels good to build these things and launch them, and then watch them out in the wild as people start using them. and then for the worst part about it, I would say, is that it can be stressful. When I was younger and I got involved in the internet, my father thought I was crazy because he said, well, isn't that thing on 24 hours a day? And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, boy, yes, he did. The internet does not shut off. And that means neither does a lot of our digital products or applications. So, and they need support. So, it can be stressful, when you're on a launch day. But other than that, once it's out there, it feels pretty good.
What is your next big thing?
My next big thing is the focus on the future of Foundry and the impact that we want to make on the design and development community. We are currently looking at opening an office in San Francisco. So that's something I've been focused on as of recent. And then on top of that, expanding the podcast that I'm doing to doing some more video webinars and some more of those things in order to better learn and give back to the design and development community.
That's amazing. You're just almost about to double your workload, because webinars are stressful because they're real time, and two offices certainly don't sound like an easy thing to manage.
Yeah, well, I'll get a lot of sleep when I'm dead. So I like doing what I'm doing. I'm passionate about it, and the more that I can be involved and be around the people that do it, the better I feel.
Awesome. Let's go back to the main topic, which is managing people, optimizing processes in UX team. So you mentioned you have your agency, so to speak, split into halves. One is UX and design, and the other is implementation and development. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a bit more of insight how exactly that translates to actual people's roles, and how do you run that?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. You know, when I say it's split in half, it's only because there's half the people with one skill set and the other half with the other skill set. But to be honest, we try to make user experience design a ubiquitous skill set across the team. Sure, there is a person that takes on the role of UX designer, but the developer and the designer are very integrated together. They sit together, they debate features and how things should be approached. So to be honest, the way that we have our team set up and the way that I feel we're the most successful at is at some point you don't know where one ends and the other begins. They're that tightly integrated, and that's what I've found to be the most successful.
That's a great approach, definitely. In a traditional, you know, design skill set, we can observe a few classical, you know, stages, being, you know, research and exploring analytics, customer interviews, then probably wireframing, then we go high fidelity layouts or straight to coding things in front end. How do you go around talents in your team? Are they usually doing several things at once, or do you have dedicated people for each stage?
Yeah, usually I would say there is a lead for each stage. So as you mentioned, let's take user research for an example. We try as hard as possible to bring the development team along for as much of the user research phase and the discovery phase as possible. I find that better software is built when the engineer has a holistic understanding of why we're doing what we're doing versus just what needs to be done. So the more that we can bring those people that are going to be actually making the thing work along with us in those initial interviews, or client discussions, or part of just our whiteboarding sessions, has made us, you know, very efficient in the build process. Because if the developer doesn't understand why you're doing what you're doing, they make a lot of decisions in the micro. They make a lot of decisions on what happens when this button is there, or if a user experience designer might have missed an interaction or a say an error message or something. My hope is that they don't have to sit and wait for a new design or these other things. They can have a very good understanding of what success looks like for the application and be able to make decisions themselves without too much trouble.
Mm-hmm. That is for the research stage to make everyone sort of stakeholders for the project.
Correct.
And then the actual design comes along. And for example, some designers like myself don't code. And what about your designers on your team?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that some of our designers are absolutely coders and can code. Some are not. The ones that can usually are even more integrated into those projects. But the ones that don't necessarily really focus more on the strategy, the product launch, and then sometimes even the service design side of things, because, you know, any product we make, there's a lot of services that usually need to either support that product or vice versa, where the product needs to support services. So that's where those strategists really focus on the business side of things versus the code and development side.
How about wireframing as opposed to high fidelity, as opposed to, you know, click through prototypes and other possible stages, which you can, you know, you can go through all of them or you can skip on those. What do you think the ideal process is?
Yeah, for us, the ideal process has been whatever it takes to get the client to understand what they paid for and see value in it as soon as possible. For us, we usually start with whiteboarding sessions, we bring the client and hopefully some users into those sessions to start whiteboarding out the different ideas and interactions, and then the initial happy path or user flow. From there, we will take it to usually a low fidelity stage where we can really suss out the architecture. And from that, then we usually make a fully rendered high fidelity either InVision or Adobe XD prototype that we then take and test as much as possible. So that's the other thing I should mention. Throughout that process, we're trying to test at every stage. Even the whiteboards, we'll take photos of them, we'll show them to potential users and walk them through where our minds are at. We'll take the low fidelity prototype, try to walk that through potential users or customers and get feedback at that stage. So every step along the way, we're doing, you know, quality assurance, if you will, on the concepts and ideation.
Between those stages, when you pass work around from one person on the team to another, along that flow, do you adhere to a special methodology? I don't know, shipping weekly, or do you have like micro iterations when one person tells another where, well, here goes my deliverables, you know, and there's a ton of ways to do that. Yeah, what do you think is the best?
For us on our side, we really spend I like that you use the word micro interactions, because that is something that kind of happens just naturally as we have the teams integrated together. And when I say integrated, I mean physically, not just from a methodology standpoint. We physically sit them next to each other so they work together. They're there all day talking and interacting with each other. But to the more specific methodology you pointed out, we do stick to two-week iterations where we're trying to demo and ship code every 2 weeks.
That sounds great. Can you walk us a little bit through the tools that you use alongside starting from whiteboarding to the actual code?
Yeah, for the most part, we try to keep the tools as lean as possible. We do a lot of whiteboarding, a lot of photos from the whiteboarding. From there, a lot of the final designs and things are made either using Illustrator or directly in InVision. We're big fans of Sketch, but I would say that the majority of our designers really love Illustrator. And I have to say, our front-end guys that have to make SVGs all day long and use them also enjoy that they use Illustrator. So from there, we use a lot of InVision for our prototyping. We've also dabbled a bit in Adobe XD. And then if the client has something specific, we definitely are flexible and can work within the different types of tools they do use, but we try to keep it down to a minimum of two or three different tools that are interacting with the design at a given point in order to streamline the process as much as possible.
What happens next to the layouts when it's time to code? Let's say we are talking about a non-coding designer or front end. How is that? Mm-hmm. How does it get passed over to the development team?
Sure. Usually there is a kind of development kickoff where we talk about what the goals and the plans are. I would say it's not a traditional handoff where they're like, here's the final designs, because as I mentioned before, the developer is sitting next to the designer the entire time and being able to talk and interact as the designer's building these things. They're able to just lean over and say, this is how I'm planning on this button interaction or this menu working or this mobile experience working. Any thoughts on that? Oh, that, well, if you put it there, it might be a little bit more difficult to move it there, because a big part of what we do is also we follow ADA compliance, accessibility is a big part of everything we do. So having those developers and those designers tightly integrated, even as the process switched from design to development, the more they're working closer together, the better you're firing on all those cylinders on compliance and security and data integrity.
Let's imagine you have a large project. So there is your client who wants to build a kind of large web application, for example, which is obviously not mm-hmm. built like immediately. How do you go around? Does the design team start, with shipping small chunks of work and handing those iteratively to the development? Or do you have like a specific design phase and then developers start working later?
Yeah, I would say it depends, but I could give an example of a large project we're currently working on. One of the things that we do is we lay out the entire architecture for the piece and as much of the user flows as possible. And then what we do is we start to get more high fidelity on each different user type. So let's say there's an administration portal that we're building. We might start there and have the developer start putting together the front end code for the admin portal while the maybe a account person's happy path is being developed in high fidelity, and those things are starting to come together. So I would say we try to separate it out, not necessarily by feature sets, but by user flows. And that's been pretty successful for us on larger engagements.
That sounds like a great strategy too. Some agencies have, their special secret sauce elements, such as, special frameworks, template projects, living UX libraries, some, blank UX libraries that can be customized. I'm talking like Zurb framework that was specifically developed for one agency in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. Do you have any of those elements for your own team?
Yeah, to be honest, it's basically a Frankenstein of a lot of the things that are out there that have kind of come together to make our standards. And to be honest, the reason is because a lot of us come from varied backgrounds in product development. So a lot of people, as Foundry formed over the years, have as you bring on new people, they're bringing in new ideas and new frameworks and different things. It just keeps adding on and on to the things we do. But I wouldn't say we have a branded, zippy, cool, UI pattern library that we always dive back into. But we're definitely big fans of keeping an eye on what's happening on sites like Product Hunt and seeing what people are sharing there. We are very active in the community and are always going to events and trying to learn from what other people are doing out in the design and development world.
Sounds great. Actually, I don't think it's possible to be 100% perfect in real life with those things, because as you said, it's a breathing thing.
It is. It is. It's absolutely a living, breathing thing. But that's why the more you can break things down into smaller iterations, the easier it is to keep a handle on those things and be able to change, pivot as need be, as challenges arise.
Which brings us to the next question. When a new member of the team arrives, what is your process for onboarding them into specific projects or into your system in general?
Sure. So it's not anything fantastic. It's a Trello board of checklists and tickets that are assigned to different members of the team, saying, you know, here, development lead, make sure you show them where the repositories are and where these things are at. And here, design lead, show this person where our pattern libraries are. Make sure they're all set up on these things. Here to our CEO, CFO, show them what these things are. And then I usually spend an hour or two with them, kind of explaining the history of Foundry and what our future looks like. And then from there, it's usually, again, like I said, nobody is just thrown into the deep end. They're usually, they've got a life preserver of a lead hanging with them at every step of the way to make sure that they are set up for success, because there's nothing worse than, you know, being thrown at into the middle of a situation where you have no idea what the goals are. Again, you might be a great designer, but if you don't understand what success looks like, then you're going to be set up for failure. So we are very cognizant of that and are very careful with how we do that onboarding.
I love that phrase that you're using, which is, you know, knowing what success looks like for what you're building. Mm-hmm. Are there any ways of capturing or cultivating that for each individual product so that it's easy to get this message across?
Sure. And it, we also work with that with our on that same premise with our clients as well. So, for example, one tool that I like to personally use, especially for larger projects, is AHA, which is a product management tool that Atlassian bought not too long ago, because they buy everything, right? So it's great because what you can do is, as you're building out features, you can start to rate those features, and you can also bring in preliminary users to start rating features as well. So once you have a great list of great big list of features and you've got them rated and you can put them on that kind of chart that says, you know, high effort, high impact, low effort, low impact sort of crosshairs, and get an understanding on where things are, you can really start to make great decisions. But bringing somebody new into that, it's very clear and very easy for them to see how people have made the decisions that they've made and why they chose what they've chose in order to get up to speed quickly. If people just think like, oh, I need to have these wires done by the end of the week. If they don't know why they have to be done by the end of the week, if they don't understand that, we're not going to be successful and our clients aren't going to be either.
That's actually applicable to any kind of client work, even for individual freelancers and consultants. Everybody needs to have context. So as professionals, our goal is to ask questions about it. Or if we are employees who are hiring others, our goal is to tell that and make sure everybody understands, right?
It is. And as the president of the company, I need to be able to create an atmosphere where people feel comfortable asking those questions.
Absolutely. You kind of anticipated one of my questions, which was in regarding of the tools which you use for project management and for product management, which kind of cross-pollinate, I guess.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you have Trello. You mentioned you have this AHA tool. Yes, I'm going to link to that in show notes. Any other setup that you have, you know, something basic like Basecamp or Sana?
Sure. Yeah, we, you know, for our, you know, our startup clients, we usually like to use Trello and some easy tools because we want our clients in the tool as much as possible. Mm-hmm. for larger projects, we'll move into something like Jira, where we know this is going to be a year-long project and we need to have stronger reporting, better tools for anticipating velocity and those types of things for budgeting reasons. We'll use a bigger tool, like a more robust tool, I should say, like Jira. But for the startup people that we work with, where they are looking to get a prototype out in 2 or 3 months, just using Slack and Trello integrated works fantastic for what we're doing. But we also work with some enterprise and mid-size companies where we'll work either in their system or we'll utilize something like Jira for that larger engagement. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Slack, which can be, you know, a big win or a big discipline loss for the team. Do you have any rules about using it? How you can disturb or not disturb people in real time?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, it's more of a social contract that we have,
right?
within the organization. We have specifically created a channel that is just a dumping ground where people can talk about the coffee in the common area, or they can post GIFs about something, or we can talk about the design of the missile alert system that alarmed Hawaii just recently. and all that goes into one channel. So people can mute that or not mute that or get notifications or not. But other than that, it's usually it's kept to more one-on-one or one-on-two sort of conversations within the Slack interface. But providing that channel for this is the area where you dump all the typical stuff allows people to either turn it on or turn it off. So that's been a helpful use of Slack.
Great. For product management and project management, those are not only software roles, but oftentimes they're actual people roles. But sometimes it sounds like leads play a lot of that in your company. What do you have? Do you have dedicated project management managers, product managers, I don't know, anything else set up?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, it depends on the project. For the most of the time, the design lead will take the role of the product owner for those smaller startup companies. We're coaching those people and helping them hire product managers for their side of the fence at some point. So that's another thing that reason why people come to us is because we don't just build the software. We can help you start to form your organization, because a lot of us come from startup backgrounds. But when we're working with a much larger organization, a lot of times they're just utilizing us for project management, because they will have a lot of those roles on their end already kind of taken over. So currently, the way it's set up is for those smaller projects, we have that product manager role usually on the design team. But for the larger projects, it's usually a project manager that is working with the larger end client product team.
Which brings us to the next question, which is, how do you handle that transition period, the handoff period when you are shipping the product to your client, even though we all understand that software is a continuous thing and it's kind of hard to just stop working on it? How do you handle that?
Yeah, for us, it really depends on the engagement. If it is a startup, a lot of times they're going into a testing or funding space. So we're usually having conversations and strategy from the beginning on what the end looks like. So while everybody gets very excited about, you know, whiteboarding and designing what the interface and the tools are going to be, part of our strategy is also to design what post-launch looks like in terms of the engagement and start working with the client on what that's going to look like. If it's for a larger company, a lot of times we're brought in to kind of be the pace car, if you will, for mm-hmm. their internal development team. A lot of times we're having those discussions very early on what done looks like to them, at least done from our engagement side. And to be honest, we do a lot of continuous development with our clients. I would say that more than half of our clients have been working with us since Foundry was first conceived 3 years ago. So we're still working with a lot of those clients in some capacity, either as a consultant or as actual designers and developers.
I'm going to ask a question, and if it feels like wrong fit, please don't. But I'm not asking for actual numbers, but I would love to hear, because it might be hugely useful for some of our listeners who run their own agencies or teams. What is the billing structure? How do you bill? Is it by milestones, value-based, hourly, sure. anything else?
Yeah, again, that depends on the engagement, but I would say that we do a lot of workshops up front, and a lot of times those are fixed cost. The strategy sessions, the product design workshops, the architecture reviews, the service design workshops, all those things are usually a fixed cost. A lot of those are a fixed cost because we find that, getting into custom software is very frightening for some people. So the more you can productize your initial offerings, we found a lot of success with that. From there, I would say that the majority of our work is done on a time and materials basis for the larger build. But for the most part, a lot of those things are just billed on a monthly invoice. So nothing crazy.
Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense, though. So totally fine. I guess it works out for you well. Productizing the initial steps have been pretty popular. Are you open about pricing for those on somewhere in the public, or is it changing and personal for every new client?
Yeah, that's a good question. The typical product design workshop, which is our standard kind of get started sort of thing, can run anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000. But other than that, the service design workshops, the architecture reviews, all really depends on the size of the client's needs. So if we're working with a company of maybe 40, 50 people, that service design workshop might just be 2 days worth of time. But if we're working with a company that has mm-hmm. 1,000 employees, that could take a week to 2 weeks to really start to dive through those things. So those costs end up reflecting that level of effort. But I would say our standard get started with Foundry workshop starts somewhere in that range that I mentioned.
That's hugely helpful, and thank you for giving some numbers. At least that's definitely. I'm quite amazed at the scale of your project. You are saying like 1,000 people, companies as your clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. Well, again, like I mentioned, we have a real startup focus on our side, and we work with a lot of startups. But a lot of these larger organizations want to be more agile. They want to be more mm-hmm. startup-y. I'm using air quotes here. you can't see, but I'm using air quotes. They want to be more startup-y. They want to be more agile. They want to be more small team and integrated focused. So many times they'll bring in a company like ours to, like I mentioned, be the pace car, be the show. This is how it's done. This is how we work with startups. We're going to show you, much larger company, how you can also start to move that way with your development and your design efforts. And so that's where the real value has come.
So a lot of things that we discussed today were related to teams that are sitting in the same room or in the same office. Do you have any insights specifically for remote teams, which have grown to be very popular these days?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. You know, currently we don't have any remote teams that we work with on a regular basis. But in my history working with remote teams, I have to say that video conferencing has been the thing that has helped the most. When you're talking with a developer, a designer, and you're checking in on where progress is and what challenges they're facing and what things you need to be doing, body language can tell you a lot. So for me, just digital communication like email and Slack and those things is fine for here and there. You know, for most of our Scrum meetings when we were working with either nearshore or offshore people, we always had the Scrum team up on video conference to talk through what they were doing to make them feel as much as part of the team as possible. And then if it's a longer term project, I mean, we definitely made efforts to either get that person to take a trip to work out of the office for at least some part of the engagement, or even went to visit them. So for me, it's all about communication. And that's what can make people successful remotely. And it's a two-way street. You've got to be good at it, and the other person needs to strive to be good at it too.
Definitely. Video calls are definitely sort of savior when you need to build relationships remotely. One of my friends, Nick DeSabato, he's been here in the podcast as well. His absolute requirement is face-to-face video calls with his clients. So he would not even talk to you if you can't switch on video.
Yeah.
And I kind of get that.
It's really important. I've been doing software and design and development for over 20 years. And the thing I've learned the most from it is that it is a people sport. It is about trust, and it is about communication. Maybe you've got a so-so designer and maybe a junior developer. If you've got great communication and you've got a solid plan and you've got a vision for what you're trying to do, you can set almost anybody up for success, as long as they also are willing to trust and be a part of that communication loop.
You probably have a huge network of friends and fellow agencies and other people who do client work. Have you encountered any exotic setups that also worked fairly well, or do you feel like everyone is doing a very, very similar thing with running their agency?
I think people have a different flavor for how they like to do things because everybody kind of has a different background and a different experience. For me, I've found that we've definitely moved into a much more product design and service design focus as an industry as a whole, even for websites, like a simple marketing website needs to have some sort of service layer because people are doing things like chatbots. So what happens on the other side of like, okay, let's put up the chatbot. Now what do you do? What's your rules of engagement for the chatbot and who's going to be responsible on the business side of these things? So I think it's a responsibility thing. I think people are selling the new hotness all the time, like what's going to be the next big marketing thing. But they're not as focused on the business side, the business impact those things have and what sort of value those create. So for me, what I've seen more so than people trying to just sell butts in seats, mm-hmm. if you will, is to really focus on value in selling a value outcome, not a website or an app. But I've found that the people that I've worked closely with have been focused on selling value first and then implementation second.
Let's imagine there is someone among our listeners who is setting up a new agency, first time in their life. What would be the top two or three mistakes that they should absolutely avoid while setting up their processes and client work organization?
Sure. Number one would be the easy trap to fall into is being very internally focused, is being only focused on what you can see in front of you. And as you mentioned before, I've had a strong focus on network, because I don't look at anybody that does product design and development like Founder does as a competitor. I view us all on the same side, and that we need to be working together to improve our craft and to improve our businesses as a whole. It's a big world. There's like 6 or 7 billion people. There's plenty of work out there.
Oh, yes. Everybody's a friend, not a competitor. So, exactly.
Exactly. So, but people can become very internally focused and driven. And if you change that mantra to what can I do to help build my business, but what can I do to help build other people's businesses? I found that karma, if you will, comes back 10 times over and over.
That is great. That is great. Anything else that you see as common traps to fall into?
Yeah, putting process over people definitely is another one. Making, process has its place. Process is important, but sometimes people who have a strong sense of imposter syndrome will try to process it out of themselves, where they'll create all these gates and checks and balances and methodologies and frameworks and all these different things to compensate that they feel a bit insecure about their ability overall. So for me, I would say to constantly be checking to make sure if you're adding processes to what you're doing, are they truly of value to your client at some point? Or are they just focused on trying to make your life easier? Not suggesting that you shouldn't do things that make your life easier, but in the long run, if your goal is to build digital products, websites, or service clients in any fashion, make sure that whatever you're doing has a real focus on creating value for that customer, not solely just for you.
It's such an easy mantra to actually help other businesses instead of just charging and growing your business, but not everyone follows that.
Right. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
As we are wrapping up today's episode, I would love to hear where can people find you online in your work and your agency?
Sure. So Foundry, you can find out more about us at foundrymakes.com. That's foundrymakes.com. Myself, personally, and Foundry has a big social presence. We're all over the Instagrams and the Twitters and all those things, as am I. If people wanted to reach out, I have a website for the podcast. It's the schmidtlist.com, or it's schmidtlist.com. It's schmidt-list.com. And you can also find me on LinkedIn, Kurt Schmidt. I'm on Twitter, and my handle is @KRTS. And, for me, the more that I can be out in the community, learning what's making people successful, sharing what's making us successful, in the long run, for me, just makes all of our lives better.
Thank you so much, Kurt, for making time for us today. It was a goldmine of advice for people who are doing the same as you. So thank you.
You're too kind. Thank you, Jane, for the opportunity. I'm a big fan of your podcast, and I wish you all the success.
Thank you, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.